This is Upfront, Dispatches from the New Majorities. I am Sandeep Roy. Coming up, who's afraid of the China spy?
You know, first of all, I think we have to assume that both China and the United States are spying on each other all the time. It's a question of, you know, who gets caught.
Another kind of neighborhood watch. A local newspaper takes on crime. And who's coming to the neighborhood?
When Reggie walks in the door, Miles makes all kinds of assumptions about him based on his race.
A new play about race, class, and your next-door neighbors. Songs sung black. African-American women songwriters have something to say.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn.
But first, these views from the ethnic media.
In Zacatecas, dos jóvenes de 15 años
Kangwa, Japan's 국교 정상화 교섭대회
were made to gangsters in Tokyo.
有驚無險,疑犯原來不是第一次見面。 With a roundup of views from the ethnic media, I'm Odette Keeley. This week, Pakistani Americans are divided on the upcoming Pakistan election. A Chinese group protests a CNN segment. And a possible African-American vote surge for McCain. Barack Obama's sweep of the Potomac primaries may have given him an unbeatable lead over Hillary Clinton. James Wright, political reporter for the Washington Afro, was surprised by the turnout.
We knew that Barack Obama was going to get a high percentage of the African-American vote in Washington, D.C., as well as Maryland, and particularly Baltimore County and Prince George's County. What was surprising is the turnout. The turnout was very strong for Obama in terms of the votes. So while we were not surprised by the percentages, the people who turned out to vote is what really, really made it sweet.
And Republican John McCain might get a second look from African-American voters.
When black people look at John McCain, they may see that he is not as offensive as other conservatives have been in the past. And in terms of growing, no, I don't see it right now, but that could definitely change, particularly if there is a perception that Barack Obama has been done wrong by the Democratic establishment in terms of getting the nomination or being on the ticket. Also, John McCain, should he choose an African-American runner mate, he would definitely get a serious look by the African-American community.
James Wright from the Washington Afro. A Chinese advocacy group called the 80-20 Initiative is protesting a CNN story on the presidential race. The two-minute video segment suggested that Asian American voters are supportive of Hillary Clinton because they don't want change. That sparked an online protest against the cable network. Kaiping Liu, deputy city editor of the World Journal, says the story claimed a more sinister reason for the Asian support for Clinton.
According to 80-20, they think this coverage hint that most of the Asian voters, they don't like Obama because of the race.
Liu says the World Journal is not taking sides.
So far, we don't take any position. We're just telling the readers that 80-20 initiative is protesting CNN. They're just asking people to sign the petition to protest.
Under suspicions of manipulating it, Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf is holding an election for a new parliament. Election day is Monday, and Pakistan news writer Jehangir Katak says many mainstream U.S. media are watching Musharraf skeptically.
And every time New York Times or Washington Post writes an article or an editorial opposing Musharraf or demanding his removal or asking Bush administration to stop supporting him, it's music to the ears of the opposition activists in America.
Katak adds Pakistani Americans are divided between either supporting Musharraf or the opposition.
And they have been expressing their views in different forms. In fact, the Pakistani Americans are also demanding that the government of Pakistan allow them representation in the Pakistani parliament as well.
Those are some of the views from the ethnic press this week. For New America Media, I'm Odette Keeley.
This is Upfront. I'm Sandeep Roy. A new China spy scandal erupted this week. Two immigrants from China and Taiwan were arrested, as was a Defense Department analyst and a former engineer for Boeing. The Defense Department analyst was accused of selling classified information about U.S. weapons sales to Taiwan to a Taiwanese-American furniture salesman in New Orleans, who then passed it on to China through a Chinese go-between. In another case, a Boeing engineer was charged with stealing data on U.S. aviation, including the space shuttle, for over 18 years. With arrests in both cases made on the same day this week, it's hard to avoid parallels with another Chinese spy case from several years ago, that one involving nuclear scientist Dr. Wenho Li. Ling Chi-Wang, Professor Emeritus of Asian Studies at UC Berkeley, joins us to tell us what's changed since Dr. Wenho Li. Ling Chi, if you look at the latest Chinese spy stories, is the coverage in mainstream media different from the Wenho Li case?
Very definitely. I think in the case of Wenho Li, it was top of the news on every front page of American newspaper. And then from then on, it was kind of like wall-to-wall coverage, feeding frenzy every day in the media and on national television and radio. It was, you know, it was really quite disgraceful when you think about this man who had not been charged, only a rumor that he was suspected, and yet the newspapers essentially really convicted him.
So in this case, it seems like they're proceeding much more carefully, at least the media
very
is.
Carefully, because they got burned very badly last time. And so this time, the most newspapers treated, you know, buried it inside, not giving it any prominence. And besides, you know, we're not even sure, for instance, in the case of the Boeing engineer, we're not even sure if anything would get passed, and especially the one involving the Defense Department's sales of weapons to Taiwan. We are not even sure whether anything got passed on, because the FBI said that they decided to make the early arrest for fear that something, you know, important may be leaked to China. This was China supposedly trying to secure these secret documents about what pending sales and what had been sold to Taiwan. And of course, China was very, very sensitive about this.
Which is also very interesting, Ling Chi, because it's the U.S., America, and Taiwan involved in this spy story. Has that been stirring a hornet's nest in the Chinese media here? Because if it's true, this person would be betraying both America and Taiwan.
Yes, it has received very, very extensive coverage. I would say that even better coverage than the mainstream press. And, you know, there's an article in Financial Times originated from Taiwan reporting that the Taiwan government is now launched an investigation into possible, you know, leaks of its information as these military secrets to mainland sources. So you could see that this is going to be quite a three-ring circuit in a way. But just exactly what was going on, we really don't know at this moment. And the Justice Department's release information still is very, very sketchy. And the person, by the way, who is suspected of trying to secure information from the officials within the Defense Department in Pentagon, actually was characterized as a longtime resident of New Orleans, owned a very exclusive Chinese restaurant, and also, as you said, a furniture store. And they said that they could not possibly think about him being a spy. So this is going to be an interesting story to follow.
How has the Chinese government's reaction been to this?
There's been no comments coming out of the Chinese government.
Is that weird? Is that strange?
The government is making a big deal out of it because they, of course, hope to cause some tension between China and the United States.
But is it surprising that the Chinese government has not commented on it?
Not really. I mean, Chinese government has always stayed quiet about these things. I mean, for instance, they stayed quiet about the Wenho Li case. They didn't say anything. And then they stayed quiet about the Larry Wu Tai-Chin, the CIA man who was accused of spying. No, I think that's actually pretty routine.
Now, the Assistant Attorney General, Kenneth Weinstein, described China as, and I quote, particularly adept and particularly determined and methodical in their espionage efforts. Now, is the prospect of a China spy a bigger worry now for the U.S. than even during Wenho Li's time?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, I think we have to assume that both China and the United States are spies. spying on each other all the time. It's a question of who gets caught. And then besides the military kind of espionage, of course, you also have a lot of industrial espionage that's taking place everywhere. In fact, not only across the country, but also among, for instance, American companies. They're also doing a lot of spying because they want to know what their competitors are doing. So these are kind of, I'm not surprised that these things are going on. What's surprising is that not too many people have been caught. But in the case of the Chinese, however, though, I think that the Justice Department's officials, to me, is very prejudicial in the sense that, in terms of what he said. What he said is actually very similar to what J. Edgar Hoover started saying back in the 1950s. There's an automatic assumption that, first of all, China, is always going after our high-tech and military secret. And secondly, that China always used Chinese Americans to do the dirty work for them. And so far, Wen Houli is clearly a victim of that. And there were a lot of other, Captain James Yi, who was also wrongly accused and then eventually freed. And that case actually happened after Wen Houli. And then there's Katrina Leung from Los Angeles, also the same thing. I know of at least, since Wen Houli case, at least no less than 10 cases, and most of which have not resulted in any kind of conviction that I can think of. I mean, oftentimes these people are forced to plead guilty to some lesser charges, not from the original charge. I mean, like, for instance, in the case of James Yi, originally charged with espionage and treason, eventually they tried to drop all that and then try to force him to admit that he had he was in possession of classified material and then in possession of pornographic material in his personal computer, and then eventually even those were dropped, and then he was completely free and then honorably discharged.
Thank you. Ling Chi-Wang is Professor Emeritus of Asian American Studies at UC Berkeley. This is Upfront. I'm Sandeep Roy. The juvenile crime rate has spiked nationally. Statistics show that in Oakland, youth aged 18 to 25 are at the highest risk as both perpetrators and victims. If you looked at the numbers from the Oakland Police Department from January through July of 2007, you'd see 85% of the suspects are black men, 60% of the victims are the same, and 14% are black women. Community newspaper The Globe decided it didn't just want to report on these depressing numbers. It launched a series called Seeking Solutions to Black-on-Black Crime. Eleanor Boswell-Rain is the associate publisher and the managing editor of The Globe. Welcome to Upfront.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Eleanor, the crime statistics are always in the news, and they tend to be fairly dire. But what prompted The Globe to launch this series called Seeking Solutions to Black-on-Black Crime?
We're a community newspaper. We're very involved in what goes on a daily basis in our communities. We deal with average people who are just, they've had it with all of this crime that's going on in their neighborhoods. Since they read The Globe, we thought maybe we could help people on an individual level feel that they have more control over this thing called crime or violence in their neighborhoods.
But what about the neighborhoods themselves? What are you finding out about how communities are coping and trying to just live in what you call in your editorial the circle of violence?
It's very dire, and that's another reason why you'll see in every one of our series articles about how it's affecting individual people who are living under those conditions, whether they are victims of crime, perpetrators of crime, or just coping with their relatives who literally are dying in the street.
Can you give us some examples?
What we do is we publish poetry that we have some poets that are actually in prison who write about what their conditions were like. We have victims who will talk about things like, since 2005, I've lost six of my best friends, or I know that I'll never live beyond the age of 15 or 16.
David Muhammad, who used to be run the Mentoring Center in Oakland and is the editor, I guess, of the series. It was one of the things I was really interested in reading, where he says it's now less about gangs than it is about cliques. And that most, or not most, a lot of the violence, when you ask people why was there violence, one of the most common answers is, he disrespected me.
That's right. That's right. It's a departure from what we think of in terms of the gangs, the Crips and the Bloods and that kind of thing. This is something that is a hybrid of a gang. It's brought about by some of the same reasons that there are gangs, but I think the whole culture is different in that it's a mixture of drugs, of alcohol. It's a mixture of helplessness. It's a mixture of poverty. It's a psychological sense that life is short and it doesn't mean anything. There are a lot of dynamics at work that have caused this culture. The music that encourages, romanticizes this violence is something that we've really never, as a society, dealt with. And we're struggling to find ways to do that.
And do you find that examples from people in the neighborhood, maybe as you're doing the series, are people coming forward with their examples of their own coping strategies or how they are trying to make a difference?
We're finding a combination of things. Yes, we are getting a lot of response. We're getting responses even from kids in juvenile, in the juvenile justice jails and so forth, who are developing poetry to talk about what it's like and why they've chosen. We've also had some saying, I'm going to change my life and this is how I'm going to change it. We get a lot of feedback.
For example, I think you've talked about crime victims and their clothes, which have blood on them. What's the story with that?
Well, the thing is that often when a crime happens and there are victims and blood has flown, there are people who were there who will end up with blood on their clothes. And often those people have nowhere to go. They have to leave the crime scene. But the next day or the following day, they're wearing the same clothes with blood on it. So one of the organizations called Youth Uprising in Oakland has asked the community for clothes, you know, so a way that someone could volunteer to be part of this movement to try to quell this crime is to fill that hole. You know, could you donate some clothes so that we'll have clothes to be able to give people who are either victims or witnessed a crime and have blood on their clothes. So there are these small things that we can all do, that we can all get involved with, that is part of this process of intervention and caring.
And how can the community and the police get along more constructively in way? I mean, there's so much debate about, do you need more police on the streets or less police on the streets? Mm-hmm. What are you hearing about that?
Well, what I'm hearing is you need, in addition to the dealing with the crime police, you also need a cadre of police who are linked to the community, who are working with the prevention side, who can help some of these at-risk youth who haven't really gone over the edge. Help them not to go over the edge. It's almost like you have to look at the whole thing almost kind of as a medical person would look at the triage. You know, who can you help? And the police can be very helpful in that regard as partners rather than just there to deal with the crime.
How long is this series going to be running for?
2 years.
And you have a column, for example, as part of this series called What's Working. Mm-hmm. What did you find that is working?
Well, there are a number of different approaches that are being tried in all over the United States, and that's what we try to bring to bear. Boston had an approach of intervention. Many different cities have had approaches. So what we do is to try to put that in front of people so that it helps them understand that there are approaches. What I'm finding from the cities in particular, if you look at Oakland, who now has established an office within their structure, has already taken money from their general fund for the next 10 years that it will be devoted to crime prevention. A city like Richmond, who has established the Department of Neighborhood Safety, complete with a staff and a percentage of the general fund. I mean, what we have to make sure of is if we have a solid program in place, it has capacity, it involves people in the community, and that it can be sustained. It cannot operate on a deficit basis.
Could you give us some examples of a couple of the stories that you actually wanted to do in the series that you're maybe planning or you have already done?
Well, you know, David really is the guy who can tell you. And every week he comes up with different stories. But what we want to do is talk about the drug scene and really what is the impact, because that's only one piece of it. We want to talk about the causes of unemployment and poverty. We want to talk about how business can intervene. One businessman I was talking about who we're going to interview started a program in his cities called Light Up My City, which simply means that the Chamber of Commerce got together with their business community and agreed that every building would have lights. What does that do? It does reduce the incident of crime.
Well, we'll be checking in with you hopefully in 2 years. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Eleanor Boswell-Rain is the associate publisher and the managing editor of The Globe newspaper, which has launched a series called Seeking Solutions to Black-on-Black Crime. This is Upfront, Dispatches from the New Majority. I am Sandeep Roy. It's not just about drugs and guns. As neighborhoods change, ethnic tensions are also inevitable as stereotypes rub up against each other. What happened to the old diner? Why are the street signs now in Chinese? In Diana Son's new play, Satellites, an upwardly mobile couple, a Korean-American architect, and her African-American husband have to face their own internal racism as well as adjust to a new, predominantly black neighborhood in Brooklyn. New America Media editor Andrew Lamb spoke with Kent Nicholson, who directed the West Coast premiere of Satellites, currently playing at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley.
Ken Nicholson, welcome to Upfront.
Thank you very much.
Give us a brief synopsis of the play, please.
Satellites is a play that concerns a mixed-race couple, a Korean-American woman who is an architect, and her computer guy husband who is African-American. They have just had a baby who is now 6 weeks old, and they are moving into a not quite yet renovated Brooklyn brownstone that they are in the process of renovating that is in a predominantly African-American section of Brooklyn and a slowly gentrifying neighborhood.
Well, it's actually a very layered play with a lot of tension. And I saw it and I was stressed out for maybe half a day.
Well, good. Then I did my job okay, yeah. I guess.
But, you know, it's hard to come out with a central theme as, you know, motherhood and work, this money problem, a sex problem, a race problem, internal racism problem. How would one trying to find a way to frame this very complex story?
Well, it is a very complex story. And I think one of the things that Diana Sun, the writer, is trying to do is to express her view of living in the world as we live in it now. I mean, it is a world in which cultural definitions are breaking down or changing in some way, shape, or form, in which this notion of gentrification, I mean, there's another play playing right next door, Berkeley Rep, that takes on a similar issue. It's obviously something that's on a lot of San Franciscans' minds right now. how do you move into a neighborhood that has a cultural history of its own, and what are you bringing to it?
Mm-hmm.
It's largely based on her own experiences. She's not the main character by any stretch of the imagination, but she's definitely writing what she knows, as they say.
Sure.
And I think part of what she's trying to do is show that the world is a very complicated place.
Sure.
And so by putting these people in this extreme situation, she gets the opportunity to tackle a lot of different issues and see how they bounce off of each other. You know, the notion of race and cultural identity bouncing off of the idea of being a working mom. And what does that mean? What takes priority, motherhood or career? You know, those things in some ways go hand in hand.
And you talk about stretching imagination. Well, you're neither Black or Asian.
No,
so,
<I'm not. laughs>
So how do you connect to the play yourself?
Through a number of things. I mean, I live in a very mixed area of Oakland and feel very connected to that particular part of their struggle of this idea of this gentrifying neighborhood and what happens when the outsider moves into it. I wouldn't necessarily say that I'm gentrifying the neighborhood that I live in, but mm-hmm. by the same token, I definitely am not coming in with the same cultural kind of time legacy of the people who live in the neighborhood that I'm in. So how do I fit into that? Where do I fit into that? And how do I deal with my neighbors at that mm-hmm. point? And how do they deal with me? And that, I think, is something that I've very, very strongly felt in terms of my own connection to the play. The other stuff is all, you know, dependent on the actors. I mean, the actress playing the main role is Asian American. The guy is African American, and they're bringing their own stuff to the roles mm-hmm. as well. As well as the woman playing Nina, the main character, is also a relatively new mom. Her mm-hmm. daughter is now 3 years
Interesting.
Old. You know, so she's able to come in and say, well, you know, this is partially my story, and I can add this layer yeah. to it. And so you rely a little bit on who you bring to the table to work with you.
Now, Satellites is premiering in the West Coast,
mm-hmm.
but it's been playing in the East Coast and especially, I guess, in New York. And
yeah, it's had one other production. It yeah. had a production in New York. The play was written for Sandra Oh, who, mm-hmm. of course, most of us know from Grey's Anatomy. And it had a good 4 to 6 week long run mm-hmm. At the Public Theater in New York.
Do you think it resonates differently? Because if you were a New Yorker seeing this brownstone area, you know, you would relate it differently than, say, someone in Berkeley thinking about, oh, you know, what it's like to gentrify.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I think there's some jokes woven into the text that just don't get laughs for us.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time in New York. Some of the actors have spent some time in New York, so there's definitely things there that we were attuned to that may get a few giggles from mm-hmm. the people who live in New York or who have lived in New York in their lives, and they understand what those references are. Beyond that, I do think it's a pretty common story in urban areas mm. these days, and particularly in the Bay Area, because I think the problems of space that affect New York are mm-hmm. also problems that affect San Francisco and the Bay Area. There's a limited amount of space, and there yeah. are increasing numbers of people, so where do you go?
Yeah.
San Francisco in particular, I think, has experienced similar housing crunches as New York. So that aspect of it completely renovates. When you talk about million-dollar homes, you know, that everybody in the audience knows exactly what that means here. So.
Yeah, you're talking about a two-bedroom.
exactly. So a lot of that stuff translates. And, of course, that's the emotional core of the play. So that's really not an issue.
Sure. You know, what's interesting to me, at least, being, you know, Asian American and an immigrant, is that every time I see a play about a film about race relation, I'm thinking dealing with the other. But what draws me to this play in particular is how there is this internal racism that is occurring for both main characters.
Yeah.
You know, Nina has this, you know, both longing and kind of revulsion against her own culture, and Miles is drawn toward his white adopted brother more than he is to his Black neighbor.
Right. Well, he doesn't understand his Black neighbor because he was raised in a completely white environment. And I think that's part of what drew me to it as well, because I think there are no easy answers here. You know, these characters are wrestling with something that runs very, very deep inside of who they are, which is, who are they exactly? And so when Nina makes the mistake of judging Mrs. Che, one of the other characters in the play, based on the fact that she's Korean, there are all kinds of assumptions that she layers in which come out. And some of them are fair and some of them aren't fair, as we learn, right?
Yeah.
And the same is true with Miles and Reggie, the black neighbor. And when Reggie walks in the door, Miles makes all kinds of assumptions about him based on his race and what he looks like.
And his class.
And his class, absolutely. And what's fascinating to me is we actually played those up in this particular production. I wanted Reggie to feel like some kind of threat. As you move through the play, what you learn is, in fact, that that's what he looks like.
Yeah.
He's just, that's the culture. That's how we view the culture. And actually, you know, coming back to your previous question about what I bring to the play, because I'm a middle-aged white guy, you know, that is one of the things, is I can look at what the cultural cliches and stereotypes are and kind of play those into the audience's expectations. Mm-hmm. I can be a surrogate audience in some way.
Well, you were also talking about space and shortage thereof.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it fascinating to be in plays that are particularly small and intimate, because you're practically next to the actors, and it feels uncomfortable at time when the tension rises, because you know, when someone is yelling, you feel like flinching back, and you're right next to them.
Yeah,
and it's a different kind of experience in terms of play viewing.
Yeah, the Aurora is really great for that. If that's the kind of theatrical experience that you like, a lot of the actors, I mean, the actors have worked all over, but all of the cast members, this is their first time for this particular theater, and all of them have commented to me about how they feel closer to the audience in this particular space than in any other theater they've worked at. In fact, if you're sitting in the front row, your feet are basically on the set.
Yes. I saw someone had to pull his leg back quickly because the actors was walking over him.
Right, exactly. And so the interesting thing to me about that space, also because it surrounds three sides of the stage, is you really can't escape it. I mean, you talked about that sense of feeling nervous and you know, stressed out after seeing the show. And the play has a kind of escalating tension, which is intentional. And I think in that space, you really feel it in a way that you wouldn't necessarily feel it in some larger theaters. So you actually become a part of the action in a different kind of way, because you are essentially taking the same emotional journey as the characters rather than just intellectually watching it.
Let's get back to Satellites. You know, I thought it was interesting how he's a black man marrying to an Asian woman, and they seem to have transcended the problem of race.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, to be open-minded or to accept the other race does not necessarily solve the problem of living in the 21st century in America.
Right. I think that's, in fact, exactly what the conflict in the play between the two of them is. They have not solved the problem. They've ignored the problem.
Yeah.
They just haven't addressed the problem. I mean, I think there are some allusions in the script that certain things have happened along the way that they've had to deal with. For example, Nina makes a reference to her mother being accepting of Miles. And so obviously there was some fear at some point in time that maybe they wouldn't be. But the end result is that, in fact, part of what draws them to the periphery characters, the nanny and the neighbor, is exactly also what pushes those people away from them.
Yeah.
And that is the fact that they're not dealing with their own cultural identity in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
So at the same time, they're kind of rejecting it on one side when they're looking at the other person. They're also not accepting it within themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually part of the internal conflict for the
characters. Well, you know, it's also interesting the fact that as a journalist, I'm covering the primary. And here is watching a play that somehow has resonance, because in journalism, we are wondering, should we cover so much about race and gender, or should we just look at character and so on? But you can't really separate the two, you know, because in some way, you got to deal with the whole package.
Well, you know, there's a sensibility that, and I think it's woven inside this play, that racial identity is in some way a cultural construct.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, but that is our culture.
Yeah.
Right?
And you cannot solve it by ignoring
that's
it.
That's exactly right. You have to, on some level, identify what that construct is, if in fact that's true. And I think that's the part that Nina and Miles have glossed over. And I don't think it serves anybody to not have the dialogue. Personally, I don't think it feels it serves anybody to not have the dialogue about race. But it also doesn't serve anybody to lock those racial dialogues into certain categories.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that we're overlooking right now. When we talk about do we talk about Obama's race or Hillary's gender as a part of the equation here? Well, sure, we should, but let's not be stereotypical about it, because neither one of those two are stereotypical in any way. So,
well, Ken Nicholson, thank you for talking with us.
Great. Thank you very much.
Kent Nicholson directed the West Coast premiere of Satellites, currently playing at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. He spoke with New America Media editor Andrew Lamb. You're listening to Upfront, dispatches from the new majority on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. I'm Sandeep Roy. For more stories, visit us on the web at newamericamedia.org. In political campaigns these days, race and gender are very much in the spotlight. Is America ready for a black president or a woman president? Well, what about both? The subjects of LaShonda Barnett's book, I Got Thunder, have to take on both race and gender, but through music. I Got Thunder is a collection of interviews with black women songwriters on their craft. Let's start with one of them, the unmistakable Nina Simone.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi, goddamn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet.
That's Nina Simone singing one of her most famous songs, Mississippi Goddamn. And she's one of the 20 black women songwriters interviewed by my guest LaShonda Barnett for her book, I Got Thunder. LaShonda, what did Nina Simone say about how that song, Mississippi Goddamn, came about?
Well, she spoke in general terms about how several of her sociopolitical songs came about, such as Mississippi Goddamn, Old Jim Crow, Four Women, all of these songs she penned between the years of 1963 and 1968. Nina Simone was very, very inspired, of course, by the plight of black Americans during the mid-20th century. She, like all other Americans who were conscious during the period, was face-to-face with a real struggle for civil liberties for black Americans. She was very, very involved with the civil rights movement. She gave lots of benefit concerts for the SNCC organization, for CORE, with Mississippi Goddamn specifically, which of course was inspired by the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing in 1963, where four young black girls were killed. As soon as Simone heard the news, and this is reported in her autobiography with Stephen Cleary, entitled I Put a Spell on You. As she writes in her autobiography, she retreated to a room, and at first she tried to build her own cap gun. And then her husband at the time, Andy Stroud, said, Nina, that's not you. You know, your music is your weapon. You're not going to go out and shoot anybody. And 4 hours later, she emerged with Mississippi Goddamn. What's very interesting about that song is that it has a very jaunty musical backdrop. So she's punning on American musical theater. And she even says in one of the live recordings, this is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. So she's signifying and punning on what we do with American stories, how we put them on stage and sort of romanticize them.
What was it like to interview people like Nina Simone? I mean, Nina Simone sounds pretty intimidating. She certainly tossed out bombshells like, I don't like America, and she compares rap to slavery.
Exactly. Those are stunning comments. Simone is an icon, of course. So are people like Odetta and Miriam Makeba and Abby Lincoln, certainly because these women's histories, personal histories and musical histories precede them, I went into the interviews more than daunted. I consider it an honor. I mean, what a privilege to talk to Nina Simone. I didn't interview her face to face. We had a telephone interview in 99. And then, of course, she passed 4 years later in 2003. So I feel very privileged to have had the opportunity to speak with her.
This book focuses on women who are songwriters. Was it unusual for women to be writing songs?
Actually, it's something that I sort of assumed women were not doing, because a lot of the R&B music that I grew up listening to, men had written the lyrics, or the women who were singing the songs had not written the lyrics. So I just sort of assumed that that was the case for most women. But then as I started to look at the women that I actually, on a personal level, gravitated towards, I noticed that they were penning their lyrics. And this is something that I started to notice around the age of 19. I'm 33 now. So about 14 years ago, I really started to pay attention to liner notes and look at themes that were emerging in the lyrics, themes like persevering through grief, encouraging oneself, commentaries on Black women's status in society, songs about history, lots of sociopolitical topics.
And did you find, especially when you were interviewing these women, that indeed these common threads ran through all of them? Were the songs coming from their race or gender or church?
Actually, a combination of all three, although I would want to correct your usage of the word church and replace it with spirituality, because definitely spirituality is a strong theme that connects up a lot of the interviews and a lot of the music, but not necessarily the Black Baptist religious tradition. A lot of the singer-songwriters that I interviewed 40, more than half of them actually find themselves spiritually aligned with different types of religion, African cosmologies, Buddhism. So not just the Black religious church tradition. But gender and race, of course, played a major role. What's interesting is that across generation and also outside of the African diaspora in America, you can see connections. When I interviewed Joan Armatrading, for example, who is from the UK, and to Kumbo Akinro, who is Afro-German, and Rosa Passos, who is in the second book, and she's Afro-Brazilian. Their lyrics are saying the same things that Black American women's lyrics are. So I think that's truly fascinating, because, of course, being Black in America is not the same as being Black in England or being Black in Germany. Yet, their song lyrics are talking about very similar experiences.
I mean, that's really interesting, because, I mean, right now with all the ink that's being spilled on Barack Obama, you hear constantly, is he really African-American, or because his father is really from Africa, is he more connected to Africa? So it's fascinating to hear when you say, no, actually, this linkages do go across. It is not just about the African-American experience.
Absolutely.
But you brought up Joan Armatrading, and I was also surprised at the amount of literary influences that there were in people's songwriting. I mean, Joan Armatrading,
she invokes Dickens and
she invokes
Shakespeare.
And then Diane Reeve says her song Endangered Species comes out of something she was reading at that time. Can you talk a little bit about that song?
Yes. Oh, I have a personal affinity for Endangered Species, because when I encountered the song, which was in 95, I was a senior at the University of Missouri in undergrad, and was for the first time in my life getting to know the literature of African-American women. I was encountering my first novels by Toni Morrison and Alice Walker, and was beginning to experience a real desire to publish my own short stories. So all of this was happening at the same time. And then I encounter Art and Survival, the album by Diane Reeves, which houses Endangered Species. when I talked to Diane Reeves about the song, she said that she had just finished reading Warrior Marks, which is a nonfiction book co-authored by Alice Walker and Pratibha Parmar about female genital mutilation. And she said after reading that book, she really started thinking about womanhood globally and realizing that although she sort of considered herself free, she really wasn't free when she considered herself as part of a global femininity, a global womanism.
So let's actually hear a little bit of Diane Reeves singing Endangered Species.
I am an endangered species, but I sing no victim song. I am an artist, and I know where my voice belongs.
That's Diane Reeves singing Endangered Species. She's one of the black women songwriters interviewed by my guest LaShonda Barnett for her book, I Got Thunder. LaShonda, the other thing that struck me while I was reading these interviews was Abby Lincoln, for example, who's one of the first interviews. She says, they don't come from a tradition that worries about pretty singing.
Yes.
And I was curious, how did these women see their singing? Was it activism, therapy, just something they had to do?
Well, some of the subjects would vastly disagree with Abby Lincoln. They really are practicing the music and very, very concerned with the aesthetic appeal of their music. They study with voice coaches. They're very, very dedicated to maintaining their instrument over time. And when I say their instrument,
their
I mean
voice.
Their voices over time. Abby often says, she's a very good friend of mine, that taking the stage is therapy for her. And she even says it in the interview, which is in the book. But Abby, it's important to contextualize her historically, because when she says no one cares whether or not it sounds pretty or not, she's really talking about her own music as a vehicle for disseminating social ideals. She came of age, musically speaking, during the civil rights period. So that was very, very important for her to say something that really mattered and not to really worry about whether or not it was a sexy ballad.
Would you say that was true since these women were singing not just songs they wrote, but songs men were writing as well, that theme-wise, would it be accurate to say they were more socially conscious than the men in terms of the issues they brought up in their songs?
Well, I do think that the women who consciously want to create their own music, they are putting in issues about gender and issues about race that male writers who are writing for them might leave out. So absolutely, I would say that that's the leaning that they all possess.
And many of them also started singing really young.
All of them were called before the age of 10. Which I find astounding. Of 40 interviews, they were all called to the music. And some of them pursued different work, different careers as a matter of course, but they all had this impulse for different reasons. Some people were inspired by family members. Some people really talk about being visited by a muse or being visited by spirit, like Patty Cathcart Andrews, who I think is just, she's an amazing performer and singer-songwriter. She's one half of the acoustic duo Tuck and Patty, and from the Bay Area. She's really a wonderful singer-songwriter. And she talks about being visited by a spirit. I think she was 6 or 7 years old while on vacation with her family in Seattle and sort of hearing this voice that told her, you will sing and everything will be all right. And there are lots of moments like that that connect all of the interviews.
So let's actually hear Patty. Well, why don't you choose one of the songs?
Learning How to Fly, which I find very inspirational.
Let's hear Learning How to Fly by Patty Cathcart Andrews.
Feel the breezes blow. It's all right. You just take your time. There's no hurry now that you're on your way when you're learning how to fly.
not your home. You've been longing for that place where you would not feel so all alone. Well, now the time has come for you to fly away. Just breathe on in, then breathe on out, and you'll be on your way.
That's Patty Cathcart-Andrus singing the song Learning How to Fly. She's one of the women interviewed in the book I Got Thunder by LaShonda Barnett. The other thing about these women singing is how much control did they have over their image, especially since they started so young? I mean, I love the quote you have from Odetta, whom Martin Luther King called the mother goddess of folk and blues. She talks about hating herself, and she has this quote where she says, I was fat and I was black and I hated everybody else. Mm-hmm. And I was curious about the idea of body image that these women struggled with.
It's interesting because as the women come into themselves as songwriters, they begin to wield more control about how their art is packaged. They really want to be looked upon as serious musicians because they are. And I think that there's been a mindset in American culture that women, that they're the voice in front of the male instrumentalist, but of course, because of the mathematical and the scientific aspects of instrumental music, that's somehow more serious than the voice and the face. So as these women take more active stances in creating the music, they're controlling their image more.
And it seemed also that several of them were resistant to being labeled or categorized as jazz singers or R&B singers.
Many of them, not way more than several, many, because they are being inspired by lots of different forms of music, jazz, folk, the gospel tradition. And so to sort of align themselves with one musical genre is to negate the other aspects of who they are musically speaking. And also it sort of says that they can't move into those other genres in the future. So it's dangerous territory.
And as you were talking to them, did you feel that there was a real sense of sisterhood among them?
Absolutely. A very concerted effort to put down on paper what it's like to be black and to be female during this time. These songs at the core are philosophical. They espouse values. They espouse observations, personal experiences. They really should be looked upon. They really should be heard with an ear towards philosophy.
And did that sense of sisterhood extend down the generation? Because Diane Reeves, in her interview, says she was listening to the same music as her mother was listening to.
Brenda Russell also said that. Yeah.
And the generations weren't so separate musically as of now. Would you agree with that?
I do agree with that because even in my own family, I know that my mother or older family members would not be so inclined to sit around and listen to my nephew's music, which is hip-hop music. So there's definitely a breakdown when it comes to community listening among the generations. However, that's not to say that artists that are coming up now are not social in the way that Miriam Makeba, Abby Lincoln, or Nina Simone are. Certainly when you listen to India Arie, who's not in this volume, but she'll be in the next volume, or you listen to Tukumbo Akinro, who is in this volume, they are talking about social happenings. They're addressing issues like homelessness. They're addressing issues like economic disparity. So it's there. It's packed differently, though. And I think the tendency, like if you hear neo-soul or hip-hop, and you're of another generation, you might be inclined to turn it off or to not zone in to it just because of the musical accompaniment. But I would encourage those people to listen to the lyrics sometimes.
So let's actually hear Tukumbo Akinro. But why don't you introduce the song and who she is?
Tukumbo Akinro is the voice to Tok Tok Tok, which is an Afro-German, it's a German acoustic band. Tukumbo Akinro is Afro-German. And the song Getaway, she penned, and it's about what's happening in our society today. She talks about a child in a third world country and what his experiences are.
Let's hear Tukumbo Akinro singing Getaway.
I want to tell a story about a little girl living in what is known as a third world. Every day it takes her 2 hours to fetch water from the well, while her brothers get to go to school to learn. Now what does it take to give her equal chances as a boy to get education? Should we play the game like a joyride, knowing the rules?
That's Tokunbo Akinro singing the song Getaway, and I'm speaking with LaShonda Barnett, who interviewed her. So LaShonda, you had this amazing opportunity to interview all these amazing singer-songwriters. But what impact did these women's songs have on you? You know, how did they change your life?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question. I'll tell you that prior to going into this project, on a personal level, I was struggling with what to do with my own creativity. I've been writing since I was 9 years old, won my first short story contest as a third grader, and have been juggling or balancing life as an academic, being a professor, and my own creative writing. And so I had a very selfish reason for going into this. I love music. But I also wanted to know how these women that I so admire were able to make that decision, to make that choice of sort of the safety of pursuing a 9-to-5 or some other job, or pursuing your spiritual calling. And all of them came to a crossroads in their lives where they had to make that decision, and they did it. And I guess I wanted to hear that. I needed to hear that on a personal level over and over and over so that I myself could do that, so that I could fully embrace my own calling and my creative leaning. Because absolutely, that's where it is. For me, on a personal level, that's where the happiness lives. And I needed to know, how do I get there?
Well, I wanted to go out with, if you are at that crossroads and you had only one song out of these to take with you as your musical accompaniment on the crossroads, when you try to choose, which would you choose?
I would absolutely choose Abby Lincoln's Throw It Away.
Let's go out with Abby Lincoln's Throw It Away.
I think about the life I live, a figure made of clay. And think about the things I lost, the things I gave away. And when I'm in a certain mood, I search the halls and look. One night I found these magic words in a magic book. Your love, live your life each and every day, and keep your head.
That's Abby Lincoln singing Throw It Away. She's one of the 20 black women songwriters interviewed about their craft in the book I Got Thunder by LaShonda Barnett. Thank you, LaShonda.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Upfront, dispatches from the new majority, interethnic, international, and intergenerational news for the new America. Upfront is also available as a podcast. Go to newamericamedia.org and click on Upfront Radio. Our engineer and technical producer is Eric Wayne. Mary Ambrose directs the show. We had production help this week from Max Klein. Upfront is produced at the KALW studio in San Francisco by New America Media. Thanks for joining us. I'm Sandeep Roy.